Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Our good martini today, Jim, is that some people in Washington actually think it's a good idea to roll out a budget, and one that's actually relatively fiscally responsible. We haven't really had a ton of opportunity to comb through Paul Ryan's budget proposal. We know he wants to reduce and simplify the tax code to two brackets, 25% and 10%. That sounds pretty good. He even rolled out a three-part video series on the basic principles of this, and here's what I think is kind of the crux of the Ryan message here.
Our plan includes no changes for those in a near retirement. Instead of government bureaucrats, puts patients in control of their health care decisions. We've proposed tax reform that's common sense, a plan that lowers tax rates and closes special interest loopholes, so our tax code is fairer, simpler, and more competitive. That's how we'll create a healthier environment for businesses to hire and expand. The common thread here is that our plan takes power away from Washington and gives it back to the individual.
It looks like this budget will not skyrocket our debt into the future like the Obama budget that Tim Geithner couldn't defend earlier this year. So while we haven't looked at all the details, it's good that they have one, and it's good that it certainly looks to be a lot more responsible than anything else we've seen.
Yeah, so I believe that was the first budget that has ever come out with its own teaser trailer on the web. This is, it looks like it's going to be one of the true summer blockbusters, Ryan budget. Democrats are calling it a horror movie, but they call all of these a horror movie. Meanwhile, the screenplay for the Democrats' budget still is in the drawing board stage. They have yet to work out some of the major plot twists. Look, you know, as far as I'm concerned, Ryan is up 2-0 on the Senate Democrats, just in terms of introducing a budget and offering a budget. We'd heard not too long ago Tim Geithner say in testimony, I'm paraphrasing a bit here, but basically when he was criticizing the Ryan budget, he said, Look, if you don't like his plans on Medicare, if you don't like his plans for entitlement reform, if you don't like his plans to bring revenues and expenditures into line, what do you want to do? He said, well, look, we don't have a plan, but we know we don't like yours. And that is pretty much the administration's approach in a nutshell. There was a fascinating story in the Washington Post not too long ago that was looking at the minute-by-minute progress of the debt ceiling negotiations last summer, and it became very clear that when Obama, you know, realized that he was going to have to sell something very difficult to Senate and congressional Democrats, he was okay with not getting a deal. And that in the end, his reelection is the preeminent goal. There is no Senate Democrat alternative. The president's budget assumes all kinds of ludicrous high taxation, tax rates will be kicking in, and the economy will be surging along in ways that it hasn't surged in many years. And it's not to say the Ryan plan is perfect. There'll probably be a lot of things a lot of Americans will find in there they won't necessarily enjoy, but it is a serious solution. And as somebody had said, that, you know, even, you know, Obama's, you know, the spin from the White House was that the Ryan plan fails to meet the test of fairness. And, you know, the probably easiest rejoinder is that the Democratic budget fails to meet the test of existence. If you don't like it, show us something different, guys. And Senate Democrats refuse to do that. It's become this kind of mentality of not really governing, but I guess you could say the mentality of the perpetual campaign, which is never put something forth on your own, turn around and attack the opposition. And whenever they try to address any entitlement reform, just go out and tear them apart, go into the usual Metascare tactics, et cetera, et cetera. Somebody joked that we're now reaching the point of Obama's Sweet 16, not his NCAA picks, but his level of the debt, as in trillions. When the debt is $16 trillion, maybe it's time to get past the usual Metascare tactics and all that stuff.
Speaking of health care, among the other things that Paul Ryan was talking about, but one of them, of course, was health care. And he says it's a choice between bureaucrats or patients and doctors making decisions. And that leads us to the president's health care plan. We know it's going to come before the Supreme Court. But it's also something the president is speaking about less and less lately because he sees that Americans still don't like it. But nonetheless, it is a significant part of the road we've traveled. This is the Obama reelection propaganda film that, Jim, I assume you have playing on a loop in your home. One of the things that they talk about in this film is how Rahm Emanuel and all these other advisors were telling the president, compromise, compromise. You'll never get what you want here. But the president stood his ground. And so here's the story that is then told by Tom Hanks and the president and his wife.
But he knew from experience the cost of waiting.
When my mom got cancer, she wasn't a wealthy woman, and it pretty much drained all her resources.
She developed ovarian cancer, never really had good, consistent insurance. That's a tough thing to deal with, watching your mother die of something that could have been prevented. I don't think he wants to see anyone go through that.
And he remembered the millions of families like his who feel the pressure of rising costs and the fear of being denied or dropped from coverage.
So, Jim, you hear a story like that and you say, well, the president didn't reach the right conclusions, in my opinion, but at least you can understand why this issue is so personal to him. Well, as it turns out, in a biography that was actually rather sympathetic to his mother, that story's pretty much bogus. The book is called A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother. The author is Janie Scott, who revealed that this dispute was not over health insurance coverage, which Obama's mother was perfectly covered when her cancer was diagnosed and had that coverage for the rest of her life, but was over disability coverage, not health insurance. Glenn Kessler of the Washington Post goes through five quick bullet points here. Number one, he says, Hank says the president knew the cost of waiting on reform, though disability coverage was not actually an issue in the health care debate. Number two, the president says cancer drained all her resources, despite the fact that health insurance paid for most of her bills. So that's not the case. Of someone being bankrupted by tens of thousands of dollars in bills, her salary of $82,500 in 1995 was the equivalent of $123,000 today. Michelle Obama says Dunham never had good, consistent insurance, but she did when it was health insurance. Again, disability insurance is the big issue here. So essentially, the story that Obama told in 2008, he's telling again, but leaving out the word health insurance because it's really about disability insurance. And according to the Washington Post, that's far less of a motivator on people's heartstrings. So a story that was blatantly false in 2008 is being retold again in a very vague and very deceptive way.
I'll just make one quick observation here, and somebody had raised the question of whether in politics the really significant lies are the ones that a politician says to the people or the lies that a politician says to themselves. No one likes losing a parent. There is no doubt that's a very painful experience for anybody. However, what is an unfortunate fact of life, i.e. death, sometimes it's easier to deal with if you have someone to blame, if you can translate it to action. And so in Obama's mind, he probably believes that the health insurance, some big, scary, faceless health insurance company is a result of, is to blame here. That you know, somehow if somebody had done something differently, he would not have gone through the painful mourning process of losing his mother. And I think it'd be kind of fascinating. I wonder if the author of that book ever had a chance to confront Obama on how he's misrepresented this tale, because I'm fairly certain that Obama would not say, oh, you know what, you're right. You know, I have, you know, as much as Obama is saying things that are not true here, I'm fond of using the expiration date statement because I very much believe that Obama believes these things when he says it. I have very little doubt that Obama that he could pass a lie detector test telling this story because he believes it to be true. The inconvenient truths that don't fit his worldview, that eliminate the convenient villain of that narrative, you know, then you'd have to accept a much more complicated worldview, that sometimes bad things happen. It's not always the fault of health insurance companies. We can't fix these things by changing laws. I think it says a lot about Obama's worldview and, you know, perhaps one more reason that perhaps this is not the person who should be in the Oval Office making the big decisions.
And it could have been a very ugly fight over disability insurance. That's very important, too. Just to follow up on the point you raised, the question you raised, Jim, when Scott's book was published, Glenn Kessler reports, the White House did not dispute her account, quote, "The president has told this story based on his recollection of events that took place more than 15 years ago," unquote.
Translation, she's right. This is something almost everyone does. Probably one of my all-time favorite Washington autobiographies is that by Robert Reich, or Reich, as Rush likes to call him, the former labor secretary who wrote a very funny account of being labor secretary in Clinton's first term. And it turns out then after a while, people went back and he described, you know, getting harangued by people at these meetings and smoke-filled rooms and all that, in smoke-filled conference rooms. And then people went back and watched the actual interaction between Secretary Reich and these people who were haranguing him on C-SPAN. And lo and behold, the C-SPAN video showed no smoke-filled rooms and that most of the questioning was quite polite and, you know, kind of standard issue and all that stuff. And Reich was quick to say, look, this is how I remember it. And it was very clear. And then, of course, I believe it was the late Michael Kelly wrote a brilliant parody of Reich's autobiography in which he was an action hero, blowing up enemy nuclear plants and saving damsels in distress and all such things. So, you know, everyone does this to a certain extent, and they kind of, you know, edit their memories to support the notions that they prefer, that they are better, that other people are not as good, not as noble, that the situation is not as complicated and nuanced. A wise leader tries to be on guard for this, and I think it's safe to say that Perhaps Obama is not as on guard in this as he should be, and at the very least, he should be a little more circumspect about making this the centerpiece of his reelection video right here, 17 minutes.
Hmm. On to our crazy martini now, and the president once again has the honor of being the featured act in this one as well. There's a new book out called Showdown. It's by David Korn of Mother Jones. It's basically the story of how Barack Obama fearlessly fought back against the Tea Party and John Boehner and Eric Cantor following the 2010 elections. And here's the quote that's getting a lot of attention here. This is from Politico, and it says, Korn also writes that President Obama blamed Fox for his midterm political woes. He told labor leaders he was, quote, losing white males because in part, fed by Fox News, they hear Obama is a Muslim 24/7, and it begins to seep in. Brett Baer quickly followed that up by saying, at no point have we been able to find any host that ever suggested Barack Obama is a Muslim. And Jim, I don't watch it certainly all day long, but from what I can see, they usually don't have a lot of guests on who go anywhere near that either. So is this just another pity party, or is this something he's just trying to get people to believe?
Well, when Obama said 24/7, you know, just as we talked about his memory being not quite accurate in that last martini, in this one, he said 24/7, and what he meant was 00. So I saw that this morning and kind of said, look, clearly this means that the folks who are helping him with the projections of the impact of the stimulus are still with him and still doing the same kind of math assistance. That this is par for the course. I would say par for the course, but to put it in golf terms, a way the president would understand. But this is what we've come to expect from this president. And my Morning Jolt newsletter today was all about how do you dislodge an Obama supporter from 2008. Obviously, some people have already kind of lost faith with the president. But there are a lot of folks who don't want to hear the president's evil, don't want to hear that the president is stupid. They're just not going to be able to make that leap. But the word that keeps coming up apparently in certain focus groups of these folks is naive. And I think you look at these stories and you kind of know that Obama is a more self-pitying figure than we certainly were led to believe in 2008. A president needs a certain amount of thick skin, a willingness to deal with criticism, a tendency to avoid despair or getting too down about these sorts of things, just to recognize that the job is going to have many difficult days, and if you're not ready for it, don't run for the job. It couldn't be a policy issue, right? It couldn't be the inability to lower the unemployment rate. It certainly couldn't be the dislike of Obamacare and its mandate and all kinds of stuff like that. Couldn't be his suspicion, going back to the, clinging bitterly to guns and religion, his characterization of those voters back in 2008. No, it's all got to be Fox News and this idea that he's a Muslim. It's a very convenient belief for the president. Kind of, takes him off the hook, the possibility that he's done anything wrong, that these folks might have any really good reason to not like his policies, that they must have the worst possible motives, i.e. thinly veiled xenophobia or racism. I'd like to think that, in the not-too-distant future, there'll be a Republican president. At some point, there'll be a Republican president who will hit a rough patch. Let's say, for the purposes of the example, it's President Romney. If President Romney has tough poll numbers and at some point he sees this and says, this is just MSNBC and their anti-Mormon bias, I'd like to think somebody around the president would say, Mr. President, there might be more than that. Assuring yourself that the reason people disagree with you is because they're terrible people full of hateful motives, that makes us feel better. But I don't think it necessarily, one, I don't think it's always accurate, and two, it tends to close off any further introspection or self-reflection or re-examination of what you're doing. And that's what we've come to expect from this presidency. Obama does not really big on re-examining what he's done wrong and what he could alter correctly for the future. It's always somebody else's fault, and that's not an attractive trait in a president. So,
American voters historically have not enjoyed whining. Hopefully that pattern will continue come November. We'll certainly see. Jim, have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Looking forward to it, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us on Wednesday for the next Three Martini Lunch.